information is free.
The law?
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge,
we care.
Appear to border
it shows.
The law?
The country.
You will remember nine you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, it made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
We are reminded that ultimately what matters is not what other people say about us, but whether we are being true to our conscience. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 204 from Media Monarchy. My name is James Evan Pilato, your host and webmaster of the site and show MediaMonarchy.com, your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. This week, Egyptian events, Super Bowls and weather controls, Goldfinger, Goldschmidt and the Grand Chessboard, Endgames, Hemlines, Holy Hexes and Prayer Breakfasts, Wall Street Terror, Soda Pot, and UFOs over Jerusalem. All that, so very much more, my friends. Episode 204, February 4th, 2011, and this is MediaMonarchy.com.
You never pay for the fun.
You'll Never Pay for the Farm. That's brand new music from the legendary band from Leeds known as Gang of Four. Their legendary reputation resting mostly on their 1979 debut, Entertainment, but that is from their brand new record, Content. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the 204th episode from Media Monarchy. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com. Your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups, and we're coming to you live, as always, every Friday morning from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org. And, of course, thanks to the affiliates that carry this show live, like the one and only ZeroPointRadio.com, simulcast live on 92.3 FM and 1670 AM in Casper, Wyoming, and thanks to the worldwide home of free speech, RevereRadio.net, and all the other stations that help promote, support, broadcast, syndicate, anything to help spread this show and this site. Huge appreciation to all of them. We'll get into the list perhaps in the second hour. We have so much to go over here. We're going to get right into it. And of course, MediaMonarchy@gmail.com is the main way you can get in touch with me. And, of course, the other main ways, twitter.com/MediaMonarchy and youtube.com/MediaMonarchy. We're on tons of other social networking sites, but, again, we're going to keep it moving. Huge thanks to Casey in San Diego for the generous donation. And if you find Media Monarchy valuable, please hit the donate button on the top right of the page. Your support helps keep Media Monarchy going and growing and building all the new additions to the kingdom. We're still working behind the scenes on navigating Netflix.com collaboration coming soon from Media Monarchy and TragedyandHope.com. And I'd also like to throw out a request for any kind of help or tips or pointers on building an app for Media Monarchy and perhaps a mobile site. If anyone has any know-how in that area, again, MediaMonarchy@gmail.com. My friends, let's glance at the news right now. U.S. jobless rate drops even as job growth disappoints. Unemployment falls to 9%. It was the biggest two-month decline since 1958. Not taking into account the fact that so many folks are probably just dropping off the rolls. Journalists face obstacles and dangers in Egypt. U.S. officials giving mixed signals about way forward in Egypt. And yes, of course, we are going to cover the Egyptian events, as I believe this show, as well as my weekly video series with James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's called New World Next Week. We discuss the situation in Tunisia, which now more and more seems as though it was a practice run for our current Egyptian events. And we're going to get to that here in just a little bit. The way we're going to start off this episode is by going down the news purge, the ugly list of headlines posted up to MediaMonarchy.com. The February 3rd news purge, You'll Never Pay for the Farm, which takes its name from our opening track that we just heard from Gang of Four. And we'll begin with BioWars EnviroHealth, and a story posted on earthtimes.org, but it's just a press release from the Rothschilds bragging that they're now acquiring a majority stake in Weather Central. E.L. Rothschild, LLC, a private investment company led by Chairman Sir Evelyn de Rothschild and CEO Lynn Forrester de Rothschild, announced the signing of a definitive agreement to acquire 70% interest in Weather Central, the world's leading provider of interactive weather graphics and data services for television, web, and mobile. Weather Central's highly accurate and personalized forecasting offers businesses and consumers a truly unique suite of science-driven weather information products. The company will continue to operate under CEO and founder Terry Kelly, as well as current management. Financial terms of the acquisition were not disclosed. When you see the Rothschilds taking over weather outlets, you know very well, and you know from their hot young Rothschild parading around with Live Aid or Earth Aid or whatever it was, whatever the global warming garbage concert was a couple of years ago, the face of anthropogenic global warming. They're buying up the fronts. As most of America looks outside and says, well, I guess they'll be shoveling 10 feet of global warming. Snow chaos, just one more sign of crumbling U.S. infrastructure. This is from the Deutsche Press Agency. The monster snowstorm hitting the U.S. this week may be a random act of nature, but the resulting gridlock will likely unleash a more predictable stream of criticism over downed power lines, airport closures, and a lack of snowplows. States, cities, and private power companies have already come under intense public pressure since December for their handling of a series of major winter storms that struck northeastern regions. If only we can fashion a large wall or blade and attach it to a big truck and somehow push the snow away, the New Yorker magazine quipped this month, mocking New York's lack of snowplows during its last major snowstorm in December. The United States is far from alone in struggling with winter madness, but the snow chaos is just one small aspect of a wider crisis of crumbling infrastructure across the United States, a problem that is more uniquely American. From the breached levees in New Orleans after 2005's Hurricane Katrina to a major bridge collapse in Minneapolis, Minnesota in 2007, there have been signs for years that much of the country's infrastructure is in urgent need of repair. Obamasiah said last week in his State of the Union speech to Congress, quote, our infrastructure used to be the best, but our lead has slipped. It's all just an accident. Incompetence. Meanwhile, worst ever monster cyclone hits Australia. And we close out the BioWars EnviroHealth updates with a few other notes. Task force to probe slaughter of sled dogs. That's right, after they were used for the Olympics, they killed them. Meanwhile, cattle population in the U.S., smallest since 1958. That's from allgov.com, and we close out from the Seattle Times. Bill Gates describes the magic of vaccines to improve humanity. Hat tip to my man Zach, who you may recall was a guest recently here on Media Monarchy, episode 200. Also, lending a hand on the new holyhexes.com site. He, like I, as you should, run searches for keywords and subjects that you're interested in and then subscribe to the RSS feed of those results. And then you can get all the related stories that come out of regional small newspapers in this country and all around the world of stories you would never really catch. And it's on to the drug war, where we begin with an unfortunate story. We take from the DailyStar.com, loose change filmmaker charged with heroin sale. Loose change filmmaker Corey Rowe, 27, of Oneonta, New York, was one of two people arrested and charged with the sale of heroin. Rowe and Daniel Mart Jr., 19, of the Bronx, were arrested after the two allegedly sold seven packets of heroin in the city to an undercover police officer. Both men were charged with third-degree criminal sale of a controlled substance. Mart was also charged with third-degree criminal possession of a controlled substance. Both charges are Class B felonies, punishable by up to 9 years in prison. Rowe, an Army veteran, was a producer of the 2006 film Loose Change, a documentary questioning the official explanation of the events of 9/11. The film was written and directed by Dylan Avery, who at the time lived in Oneonta. The other person involved in Loose Change is, of course, Jason Burmis. I suppose I don't really have much of a comment on this. I haven't seen enough to weigh in and say, oh, he's being railroaded, oh, it's a smear. Unfortunately, people even on this side of the track can do stupid things. Mother Jones asking which dangerous toxins are in your pot, as if there isn't enough to worry about. Now you gotta worry about toxins in your weed. And we close out our drug war updates with a follow-up to a story we mentioned last week, but now we have a clip for you. Pot meets pop in new marijuana soda.
Doc Weed, which is a Dr. Pepper type, kind of that cherry cola, Count of Cola, our flagship brand, which is going to be your classic cola flavor.
They have funny names and promise 12 mind-blowing ounces. They're a new line of soft drinks containing THC, the psychoactive ingredient in marijuana. The California man who created the Pot Pop says his phone's been ringing off the hook ever since he announced his product.
So I just went surfing like I always did on Monday, and then I get done, and I get in my car, and my cell phone just starts going off, and everyone's like, hey, you're really popular.
Medical marijuana dispensaries say pot edibles are a fast-growing segment of the industry.
One of the biggest negative side effects of smoking cannabis is the ingestion part. There's nothing in the cannabis that's actually going to harm your lungs, but ingesting the plant matter is what's going to do the damage. So a lot of people want to get the benefits of cannabis, but they don't want to have to smoke it.
Butler has received some criticism for creating a product which could be attractive to kids.
Makes no sense because children can't get it. You have to have a medical marijuana card, and you have to go to the dispensary, and you have to get a doctor's prescription. So I really don't understand it.
Butler, who says he personally doesn't use marijuana, plans on launching the soda in Colorado this month, followed by California later this year. Eventually, he hopes to sell it in every state allowing medical marijuana. Haven Daily, the Associated Press.
Damn, 12 ounces? We now move on to our media and memes and begin with a sad but important note to hit, in addition to our other obituaries that we're going to hit. Legendary film composer John Barry dies at the age of 77. Composer John Barry, that's B-A-R-R-Y, famous for his work on Born Free, Out of Africa, and the James Bond films, died in New York of a heart attack at the age of 77. Born John Barry Prendergast in 1933, the York-born musician first found fame as leader of the John Barry Seven. His arrangement of Monty Norman's James Bond theme led to him composing scores for 11 films in the series, among them Goldfinger and You Only Live Twice. His work saw him win 5 Oscars, while he also received a BAFTA fellowship in 2005. His most recent film score featured in the 2001 war thriller Enigma, while a musical version of Brighton Rock, created with lyricist Don Black, had its London premiere in 2004. Black, who worked with the composer on his Born Free, Thunderball, and Diamonds Are Forever theme songs, said Barry remained unaffected by his international success. The thing about John that I will always remember was he never changed. He was very much the Yorkshireman, whether he was in Beverly Hills or Manhattan. I had, and I don't even remember where I got it, a box set of John Barry's film scores. Perhaps not the best renditions of them, but a pretty exhaustive collection of all of his most famous film scores. Even things like Dances with Wolves, which I believe he won an Oscar for in Indecent Proposal. So we have that from the BBC, and we also have a few related links and videos for you to the clips that we're about to hear, in addition to a video playlist on YouTube, so you can go through and hear a lot of these great songs that the late, great John Barry created.
Diamonds are forever.
The man behind some of the most famous film music in the world has died. Composer John Barry, who wrote James Bond tracks including Diamonds Are Forever and Goldfinger, passed away aged 77 of a heart attack. He first became affiliated with the Bond franchise when he worked on Monty Norman's theme tune. His arrangement of the track led him to work on a subsequent 11 films. He composed scores for The Man with the Golden Gun, A View to Kill, and You Only Live Twice. Speaking in 2006, Barry revealed why he finally said goodbye to 007.
I did about 11 of them. And, you know, they were basically the same story. You know, there's the hero, the lady, you know, the villain. And it was a formula that worked very well. Sean, I think, was the best, you know, with all due respect to Roger Moore.
The legendary music man also worked on films including Born Free, won 5 Oscars, and was awarded the BAFTA Fellowship in 2005.
In 1962, John Barry helped introduce the world's most famous secret agent.
Bond. James Bond.
Adding that catchy guitar riff to the score of Dr. No. He would become Bond's unofficial composer, writing suave and exciting scores for 11 more 007 films. Barry's talents were no secret. He was one of the busiest composers in Hollywood. In a career that spanned five decades, he won five Oscars, his first in 1967 for Born Free. Others followed for sweeping epics like Out of Africa, and Dances with Wolves. Barry's formula for scoring a movie? You just follow the action. John Barry was 77.
Russia with Love. Music from the late, great, legendary film composer John Barry. God, I love film scores. In another life, that's what I want to do. Last Tango in Paris star Maria Schneider dies at the relatively young age of 58. And while we're going down our media memes updates, we've got an article from grist.org. Populist popcorn. What was the most sustainable cinema at Sundance 2011? Last week, cinephiles and filmmakers gathered in the small snow-covered town of Park City, Utah for the 2011 Sundance Film Festival. Many of the films at the festival were inspirational to those of us interested in creating a world that makes sense. Some dealt with the themes of sustainability, some were made sustainably, some were simply hopeful. Two of the ones they mention are the first of which I'm most interested in, The Last Mountain, directed by Bill Haney, shines a light on the dark side of our use of coal in the U.S. The film begins with the scary statistic that half of all the electricity used in the U.S. comes from burning coal, which is also the number one source of greenhouse gases globally. It then takes us to Appalachia, where 30% of U.S. coal is extracted through mountaintop removal. This practice has a huge impact on the lives and health of local residents, and the film digs deep into the struggles of the people of the Coal River Valley in West Virginia. Coal-related health issues for the local people include leaking toxic sludge ponds and copious amounts of silt in the air. On one single block in the area, six people were diagnosed with brain tumors. The story, of course, has its villains, mainly Massey Energy, Don Blankenship, the man who literally looks like he should just be twirling his mustache, tying the damsel to the tracks, Pauline, the perils of Pauline. So, The Last Mountain, coming soon, somehow. And that's not the last time we're going to mention Sundance in our coverage on this massive episode 204 from MediaMonarchy.com. Our last media meme note from Fashionista.com, and the less said about this, the best. New Lady Gaga fragrance to smell like blood and semen. We now move to Murder and Mayhem, where we have a lot of new unbelievable stories of the mass murder contagion, but we'll begin with an update on a story we've been following for the last several weeks with a question asked by Redacted News. Why is the vice president's son covering up the murder of a White House insider? Attorney General Beau Biden's office, along with police investigators, have sought to keep information about the case from the public. Biden's office asked a judge to seal a search warrant for John P. Wheeler III's home, and three search warrants for Wheeler's cell phone and his 1993 Oldsmobile were sealed at the request of Newark police. Meanwhile, a report out of Wilmington, Delaware, family of slain ex-Pentagon official wants info. The family of a slain ex-Pentagon official whose body was found in a Delaware landfill still doesn't know what happened to him, and their attempts to get more information from law enforcement have been rebuffed. Calm Connolly, an attorney for John Wheeler III's family, said he's asked forensic reports, search warrants, and a copy of video surveillance tape showing Wheeler in downtown Wilmington the night before his body was found. Connolly also noted that Wheeler's family learned only through the media last week that a medical examiner had officially determined that Wheeler died of blunt trauma injuries after being assaulted. The family was told early in the investigation that Wheeler had died of a heart attack caused by an assault. As a reminder for you, Wheeler's body was found among trash being dumped at the Wilmington landfill in the morning of December 31st. Wheeler, 66, was seen on video surveillance cameras wandering around downtown Wilmington 2 days before his body was found, looking disheveled, looking confused, looking irritated, and carrying his shoe. The garbage truck that dumped his body had collected all of its trash from commercial disposal bins in Newark, several miles from both his home in Newcastle and from downtown Wilmington. Police, who do not have any suspects, still don't know how Wheeler wound up in Newark. Then comes Beau Biden, the son of Vice President Joe Biden. Always look to see who gets appointed to which positions, whether it's seemingly for the good guys or the bad guys. You get the damage control fronts taking over of any kind of situation. We also include for you, too, DelawareOnline.com. Medical examiner says John Wheeler died of blunt force trauma. And yet another strange tale of an intelligence-connected family winding up splashed all over the front page in a salacious murder event. And like many of these stories, I hear about them first from the fantastic cryptogon.com. And I do have a collection of clips here for you that should flesh this story out for you, disturbing as it is. Julie Powers Schenecker, Army intelligence-connected linguist, murders her children in Florida.
An almost unimaginable headline out of Tampa, Florida. A mother is under arrest accused of carefully planning and killing her teenage children.
Parenting turmoil. We've seen it before, but not like this. A Florida mom is in jail after allegedly killing her two kids for being too mouthy. Tampa Bay's WFTS reporter Schenecker offered up details of the crime to police when they found her at home, covered in blood.
13-year-old Beau was first shot twice in the head in a van on the way to soccer practice. Then 16-year-old Calix, killed while doing homework on her computer, shot once in the back of the head and once in the face.
It appeared that the children never saw it coming. We don't believe that the children knew that their mother meant to harm them.
Needless to say, the neighbors were stunned. They tell Good Morning America the crime was completely unexpected.
The children's father is an accomplished U.S. Army officer currently working in the Middle East. The teens were good students and popular. It appeared to be a normal family.
Fox reports on just how calm everything seemed on the surface, giving examples of posts on the family's Facebook account. Wow, you four look so good and healthy, and what a great photo. You never disappoint. Your family is something to be proud of. Look at how happy every one of you are. Julie Scheneker's mental condition is still in question. Scheneker had emailed her mother the day before saying she was depressed. Images of her as she was taken from her home have caused some to wonder about her medical condition.
It shows tons of premeditation. And so, will mental illness be a factor in this case? Of course it will.
The Atlanta Journal-Constitution reports Scheneker is now out of the hospital after she was in ICU for an unknown condition. She will make her first appearance in court this week. I'm Alex Rozier for Newsy.com.
Police say Julie Scheneker told them she shot her children because they were mouthy and rude. Family friends tell us this was a model family and that from the outside, everything seemed ideal.
Julie Scheneker looked nothing like the wife and mother neighbors knew as she walked shaking in shackles. Investigators say on Friday she confessed to shooting her 13-year-old son, Beau, in the head on the way to soccer practice in the family car. She then went home and shot her 16-year-old daughter, Calix, in the face as the girl was doing her homework.
We don't believe that the children knew that their mother meant to harm them.
Police say they found Scheneker on her back porch drenched in blood. The teens were killed with a .38 caliber pistol purchased 5 days earlier.
These kids were special children. There's a reason why so many people are affected in our community. They've touched a lot of people's lives.
Both were star athletes and star students. This is Calix last year giving a presentation to her science class.
We don't care for it and respect it.
Over the weekend, Julie Scheneker was treated for an undisclosed medical condition. Her own mother was apparently worried enough about her daughter's depression that she called police on Friday morning for help. But her call came too late. Analysts say when mothers kill, there's a very specific logic behind that unspeakable act.
It's I produced the children, I gave birth to the children, I sort of have a right to control their destiny.
And that shaking woman must now come to grips with what's happened.
You've got shock, trauma, and probably a very little will to live.
Julie Scheneker's husband is an Army intelligence officer who was on assignment in the Middle East when all of this happened. He is on his way back, though no word on whether he'll be here today for his wife's court appearance. We're learning a whole lot more about this family and some of the warning signs that may have been missed outside their gated community this morning. This memorial continues to grow, and what makes it all hit home is that so many of those coming here are themselves teenagers, just like the victims.
Julie Scheneker cried softly in her first court appearance. The suburban mom is perhaps the last person anyone expected to see with the word inmate across her chest. Police say on Friday they went to the Scheneker's home in this upscale gated community and found her alone on the back porch.
She was wearing a robe and there was blood on her robe. First they found the 16-year-old daughter upstairs in a bedroom with 2 gunshot wounds to her head, and a very short time later they found the 13-year-old son. He was in the front seat of the family SUV.
She told them she killed her son Beau and daughter Calix because she was tired of their back talk. Inside, police found handwritten notes outlining the crime, written before and then updated after the shootings.
It's hard to believe that a mother authored the notes because it's a very methodical, non-emotional description of the murder of 2 innocent children, of her own children.
So what went wrong? In November, police visited the house after Calix told a school counselor her mother hit her, including an incident where she had backhanded her daughter in the face 3 times. They closed the case after concluding the teen had no signs of physical injury. That same month, Scheneker got into a severe car accident. The police report indicated that she showed signs of drug impairment and mush-mouthed speech. We also spoke to this woman who met Colonel Scheneker and the children at an Al-Anon meeting for families struggling with addiction. She asked us not to show her face.
I don't think anybody knew exactly what they were dealing with. I think it was kind of hidden.
She says Calix spoke first.
As soon as she tried to speak, she started bawling. There was nothing, there were no other words but my mom.
That's when she says Colonel Scheneker took over.
He didn't cry. He didn't sound depressed. He didn't sound anything. He just sounded like he was there to tell a story.
And what was that story?
That his wife had a drug and alcohol problem and that they were there to talk about it and cope with it.
And as you know, Colonel Schenecker was on assignment in the Middle East at the time of the murders. He is now back here in Tampa, and last night he released a statement saying that he is devoted to the lives and memory of his children. Police tell us they do not expect him to support his wife.
So there you have it. I'm sorry for how dark that is and for how many times it was repeated within that compilation of clips. But the pieces to pay attention to seem to be that recent car wreck where she was noted to be on some kind of drugs. And the other event that they referred to, which I'm not sure if they meant immediately before the murder, she had an undisclosed medical event. Those are going to be the key pieces. The Manchurian candidate, perhaps? She was a Russian linguist connected to military intelligence. Her husband, the colonel, connects the NSA and the military. Let's see if he gets to fly the shuttle. I'll explain that glib remark in just a little bit. We also include a video search for you, Julie Schenecker, on YouTube to get more videos as they come out. The rest of our murder and mayhem. California man arrested with explosives outside a Dearborn, Michigan Islamic Center. More on that from Detroit News. Shots fired inside an Alabama courthouse. More on that from the New York Post. Affidavit says Ohio man bragged about making ricin. That's from GlobalSecurityNewsWire.org. And we close the murder and mayhem from Reuters. Minot, North Dakota police say killer still at large. I believe three have been found dead. And why not, Minot? The military-connected town. The rogue B-52s with the loose nukes. Sending fuses to Taiwan. Guards falling asleep. All those stories we've covered coming out of Minot in the archives of Media Monarchy. We finish off the news purge with West Virginia worry, but first, our Oregon oddities. Van Jones was recently in Portland, and he, as well as the writer for The Oregonian, Steve Dwin, asked, is there still hope for Portland progressives? I believe they think there was, because that was the night Obamasiah was giving his State of the Union address, but it was a packed hall for Van Jones, and this article from The Oregonian does, of course, point out he was railroaded out of the White House after it was discovered he signed a 9/11 truth petition. The other bit from The Oregonian. Neil Goldschmidt. How much damage can one man do? There is another article by the aforementioned Steve Dewan for The Oregonian. But let's just go to Wikipedia and give you the quick breakdown on the sordid history. That's the thing. Over the last several weeks and months, we've covered stories dealing with this, and we don't call it Pornland lightly. Neil Edward Goldschmidt, an American businessman and former Democratic politician from Oregon who held local, state, and federal offices over three decades. After serving as the governor of Oregon, Goldschmidt was widely considered the most influential figure in the state's politics, both as an elected public official and as a lobbyist and public consultant, until he was revealed to have sexually abused an underage girl over a period of 3 years when she was 14 to 17 during his first term as the mayor of Portland. He was appointed U.S. Secretary of Transportation by Jimmy Carter in 79. He was a senior executive with Nike, and he was the 33rd governor of Oregon, elected in 1986. But in 2004, he was disgraced by the revelation of a long-term sexual relationship with a minor girl. That girl has now passed away, and that's why this story is gaining new life, and that's why The Oregonian and other local media are covering this story. We don't call it Pornland for nothing. Child trafficking, sex scandals coming out of the mayor's office, from then to now, to our current mayor, Sam Adams, involved with an underage male. And of course, don't forget Bob Packwood, and Tailhook. Our last note in Oregon oddities. Hole in the floor ashtray apparently leads to house fire. I don't think you need any more on that. Couple notes of West Virginia worry. First from WVRecord.com. East Bank Charleston woman sues the city and police officers for harassment. Boss hogs work from big to small cities. And our last note from murder-suicide.blogspot.com. 3 dead in rural West Virginia. Murder-suicide.blogspot.com is, I don't want to use the word great, but it is an excellent resource just to track the raw data coming out of the murder and mayhem. The mass murder contagion is, as we've called it here. That's the news purge, my friends. You'll never pay for the farm. We now move to what to me and to many others is contained within the biggest story of the week. Of course, the Egyptian events have hit full-on psychological operations level where, of course, all the armchair analysts you know and work with, of course, have their say about what they think's going on. But, of course, they're not going to pay any attention come Sunday because then it'll be Super Bowl time and they'll have something else to act like they are knowledgeable about. I did have a very smart coworker ask me what I thought was going on and what my take was. I was like, it's a color revolution instigated by intelligence insiders, and Mubarak's going to hang on as long as he can, and then they're going to put in al-Baradei. This story, or rather the angle of this story that we're going to cover, we also covered as the lead-off of the latest episode of NewWorldNextWeek.com. CIA CFR envoy Frank G. Wisner sent to speak to Mubarak. And this is posted on MediaMonarchy.com, and the article we go into on the New World Next Week episode is from the Washington Post, so to not repeat that, we'll take it from the New York Times. And this is what I originally saw in the newspaper at work. U.S. official with Egypt ties to meet with Mubarak. This is from January 31st. The Obama administration has sent a diplomatic troubleshooter with close ties to Egypt on a mission to Cairo to meet with President Hosni Mubarak and other senior officials as the administration struggles to gauge Mr. Mubarak's intentions amid the fast-moving events there. The diplomat, Frank G. Wisner, W-I-S-N-E-R, former ambassador to Egypt who knows Mr. Mubarak, landed in Cairo on Monday, said the State Department spokesman Philip J. Crowley. He declined to say whether Mr. Wisner, who served as ambassador from 86 to 91, was carrying a message from Obama. He knows some of the key players within the Egyptian government, Mr. Crowley said. The administration believed it would be useful for him to meet with Mr. Mubarak and bring his perspective, he said. The choice of Mr. Wisner, 72, a respected elder of the foreign policy establishment, raised questions about whether the administration was using him as an emissary to gently prod Mr. Mubarak to resign. Administration officials declined to say whether they had sent Mr. Wisner with any kind of message. We do have links to that full press conference with Mr. Crowley. And they do get drilled a little bit by the press on why are you sending this guy? What's the deal? When I saw this article in the New York Times on break at work, the name Wisner immediately stuck out to me, again, just through swimming in these waters and being the news junkie that I am and the amateur researcher. Certain names and certain phrases should raise flags, and Wisner is one of those names. So I'll repeat the final paragraph from the Washington Post report. Wisner is the son of the well-known U.S. intelligence officer Frank Wisner Sr., who joined the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, the CIA's predecessor, and was partly the inspiration for the character Edward Wilson in the 2006 film The Good Shepherd. Frank Wisner, born in Laurel, Mississippi in 1910. He was educated at Woodbury Forest School in Orange and the University of Virginia. He was a good sprinter and hurdler, and in 1936 was asked to compete in the Olympic trials. After graduating, Wisner worked as a Wall Street lawyer. However, he got bored and enlisted in the U.S. Navy 6 months before Pearl Harbor. He worked in the Navy's sensors office before managing to get a transfer to the OSS. In June 1944, Wisner was sent to Turkey. 2 months later, he moved to Romania, where his main task was to spy on the activities of the Soviet Union. Jumping down, Wisner remained concerned about the spread of communism and began lobbying for a new intelligence agency. This is post-war, and of course, you have to keep the War Department going, so you have to turn it into, oh, the Department of Defense. Oh, we need a intelligence agency. This is the birth of the CIA, the old boys. He gained support for this from James Forrestal, the defense secretary. With the help of George Keenan, the Office of Special Projects was created in 1948. Wisner was appointed director of the organization. Soon afterwards, it was renamed the Office of Policy Coordination. This became the Espionage and Counterintelligence branch of the CIA. Wisner was told to create an organization that concentrated on, quote, propaganda, economic warfare, preventative direct action, including sabotage, anti-sabotage, demolition, and evacuation measures, subversion against hostile states, including assistance to underground resistance groups, and support of indigenous anti-communist elements in threatened countries of the free world, end quote. So later that year, Frank Wisner Sr. established Operation Mockingbird, a program to influence the American media. Wisner recruited Philip Graham of the Washington Post to run the project within the industry. Graham himself recruited others who had worked for military intelligence during the war. This included James Truett, Russell Wiggins, Phil Galen, John Hayes, and Alan Barth. Others, like Stuart Alsop, Joseph Alsop, and James Reston, were recruited from within the Georgetown set. According to Deborah Davis in the book Catherine the Great about Catherine Graham in the Washington Post, quote, by the early 1950s, Wisner owned respected members of the New York Times, Newsweek, CBS, and other communications vehicles, end quote. In 1951, Alan W. Dulles persuaded Cord Meyer to join the CIA. However, there is evidence that he was recruited several years earlier and had already been spying on liberal organizations he had been a member of in the 40s. According to, again, Deborah Davis, Meyer became Mockingbird's principal operative. One of the most important journalists under the control of Operation Mockingbird was Joseph Alsop, whose articles appeared in over 300 different newspapers. Other journalists willing to promote the views of the CIA included Stuart Alsop, Ben Bradley. Oh, wasn't he the guy that was helping along Woodward and Bernstein? James Reston of the New York Times, Charles C.D. Jackson of Time Magazine, established by Skull and Bones, Walter Pincus, still at the CIA's favorite newspaper, the Washington Post, and it goes on. The CIA also provided them with classified information to help with their work. As if I haven't belabored this enough already, these are the guys they're sending. It may as well be the 70s again. I should have just started the show with music from Gang of Four from their late 70s album, because here we are again in the Middle East, just like Carter. And of course, why wouldn't it be like Carter? Obama-sized strings are being pulled by Brzezinski and Kissinger and Gates and all the same guys who know how to stir up regimes. They know how to overthrow nations. And with the technologies that are now available, it's a 21st century intelligence coup. We just don't know the operation name, so we'll have to wait a couple decades before we'll know whether it's called Operation Ajax or Cyclone or God knows what. A fantastic article on Global Research as we go through the rest of our related Egyptian geopolitical updates. Are we witnessing the start of a global revolution? That's the question asked in part one of an article by Andrew Gavin Marshall, again on globalresearch.ca. And we already mentioned him, so let's get clips from all these amazing folks. Again, fairly big devils on the grand chessboard. Zbigniew Brzezinski, Carter's national security advisor, one of Obama's secret string pullers. Brzezinski and his fellow Council on Foreign Relations member, CNN anchor Christiane Amanpour, discuss globalist stooge El Baradei as he prepares to hijack an Egyptian revolution.
We're joined now by a man who has helped navigate U.S. foreign policy way back during the Iranian revolution. He is Zbigniew Brzezinski, who used to be President Carter's national security advisor, joins us now. Thank you for being with us. I want to start by asking you, does Mubarak have to go, or, as the administration seems to hope, he can implement enough reforms to get through this moment? Is that realistic?
I don't think that's realistic. What could be realistic is that Mubarak himself becomes convinced, with outside advice, that it is in his interest as well as in Egypt's interest that he goes, and that he sets in motion a process which facilitates that. I think the alternatives otherwise are much tougher. Either the army cracks down and the populace increasingly turns to fundamentalism, radicalism in reaction to the crackdown, or the regime perpetuates itself and an explosion comes later and even more violently.
Well, let me ask you then, because clearly the administration is grappling with a decades-long problem, how to have democracy in this part of the world without fundamentalism filling the vacuum. Do you think that is still, particularly as you watch what happened in Tunisia, secular, young, here in Egypt, it's mostly secular. We don't see the Islamic forces right now. Do you think that is still a fear?
Well, it still is a fear, but there are some examples which are a warning to us, and there are some examples which are a possible source of encouragement. The warning is, of course, what happened in Iran, the takeover by a theological fundamentalist regime hostile to the outside world and particularly to us. The other alternative, and it's also an equally important historical nation, is Turkey, where the army has played a role of a guarantor of democracy, a guarantor of democracy, even sometimes in an authoritarian transition. And the army has made possible the evolution of Turkey. Now, if you look at the region in which you are now present, there are three great nations in that region. Egypt, with enormous history and civilization and culture. Iran, similarly so. And Turkey, with an imperial past of enormous impression. Now, Turkey certainly, I think, provides the most relevant example. And Mubarak, I think, could play still a constructive role by accepting the reality and making that change possible himself.
Zbigniew Brzezinski has called for Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak to step down as globalist stooge Mohammed El Baradei prepares to act as the Pied Piper for a revolution that has been hijacked by the global elite. Speaking with fellow Council on Foreign Relations member Christiane Amanpour, Brzezinski told ABC News this week that Mubarak must be convinced by outside advice that it's in his interest as well as in Egypt's interest that he goes and that he sets in motion a process which facilitates that. Although Brzezinski warned of a global political awakening during a Council on Foreign Relations meeting last year that threatened to topple the existing international order, it's unsurprising that Brzezinski's calling for the ousting of Mubarak despite the fact that he's been a dutiful servant of the New World Order elite. It became known in Brzezinski's globalist circles at least 3 years ago that Egypt was teetering on the edge of revolt and that another political entity would fill the inevitable vacuum of power if the elite didn't get ahead of the game. That's why the American embassy trained rebel leaders to infiltrate opposition groups from the very beginning, as the UK Telegraph revealed last Saturday. As El Baradei rises, U.S. works to size him up. That's from the New York Times. But now let's hop to Bloomberg. So we've already heard from Brzezinski. So, of course, we need to hear from Henry Kissinger praising Obama's handling of Egypt and giving Mubarak months at most.
Well, opposition protesters in Cairo are holding their biggest protest so far against President Hosni Mubarak. More than 250,000 people are taking part in Tahrir Square. We're joined this morning over the phone by former U.S. Secretary of State and Nobel Peace Prize recipient Henry Kissinger, who has a long history of brokering peace in the Middle East. Dr. Kissinger, appreciate you joining us on the phone. Some would say, of course, that back in the 1970s, you were integral and key to creating this relationship that we now have with Egypt that is now under fire. Do you believe that so far the U.S. response has been appropriate?
Yes, so far we have been acting correctly. I mean, we're playing catch-up, but so is everybody else.
Right, we are playing catch-up to everybody else. Should the U.S., as our prior guest had argued before, should the U.S. be making a stronger stance in support of the people in Egypt? I know it's in a tough spot. What would you say?
Well, we don't really know what's going on, and we don't know what is meant by the people of Egypt at this particular point. We know there are big demonstrations, and they must represent various elements that exist in Egypt. So if I understand our position, it is that we hope it will be a peaceful transition.
Well, what do you hope will be the outcome of this, Dr. Kissinger?
Well, if this were a seminar in a university, I would say what I would hope is a pluralistic government that has free elections and that has political parties and brings about the economic recovery of Egypt. But it's, in my view, there's going to be a long process until we get to that point.
And do you believe that process will end inevitably in any way, in every way, with the resignation of Mubarak?
I think it's very probable. I would say it's certain that somewhere in that process, it's only a question of months at most, that Mubarak will resign. The maneuvering that seems to me to be going on right now is to see whether the army will lead the transition or whether there will be some other group that will lead the transition.
And there have been many groups, or several groups that have been talked about, and several leaders that the people have gathered around. I want to get first your take on El Baradei and whether or not, you know, he's become sort of the person or the face of this opposition movement. What do you know about him, and how much influence is he going to have in a new government?
I know El Baradei. He is an intelligent, civilized man who has lived in exile, who has even lived in Egypt. So to me, he looks like the sort of transitional figure that emerges at the beginning of a revolution and that will, having performed his function of bringing about a transition, will disappear from the scene.
So you believe he's going to be a temporary figure?
I think almost certainly it will be a temporary figure. In order to govern, you'll have to represent some social forces, and I don't know what forces inside Egypt El Baradei represents, but that's not a useless function.
No, but indeed, no, it is not, certainly not, and you can see his influence this time around. However, some have talked about the vice president right now, Omar Suleiman, as perhaps emerging as a stronger leader in Egypt. What do you know about him?
Well, he is the head of intelligence, supposed to be highly intelligent and quite sophisticated, and he's been, I think, the liaison to at least some of our relationships in Egypt. So,
is he a friend of the U.S., Dr. Kissinger?
Well, when things reach this point, you can't classify things easily as friend of the United States or not. He is. Yes, up to now he has been very cooperative with the United States. But what will happen now is that once the transition has been completed, all the political forces are going to begin maneuvering for space and for appealing to a sort of inchoate public. You have to remember, Egypt has never had a democracy.
Bloomberg kind of pulling teeth there from the war criminal known as Heinz Kissinger. Of course, we lose greats like John Barry or Leslie Nielsen or whoever but still monsters like Kissinger and Brzezinski stalk the earth. All is not what it seems in Egyptian clashes, a great article from Land Destroyer. Meanwhile, Washington Post confirms Egyptian looters were agents provocateur. More on that from Raw Story, Washington's blog, and right to the source, Washington Post. Egypt's undercover police behind museum looting. Looters included undercover Egyptian police. That's a false flag attack. AllGov.com getting into which U.S. companies profited from arming Mubarak. U.S.-UK companies help Egyptian regime shut down telecommunications and, more importantly perhaps, identify dissidents. And some of those companies would be Boeing and Naris helping Egyptian dictatorship fight pro-democracy movement. But we've heard from, as John Hankey would call, big devils. But let's break it down with the historical outlook that you can get from tarpley.net on the destabilization rampage that is targeting the Egyptian events.
Well, the uprising in Egypt has been a particularly sticky situation for the United States, as officials here walk the tightrope between supporting Hosni Mubarak's government and supporting the citizens' right to protest. You know, on one hand, this is a government that gets $1.5 billion in assistance from the U.S. government. It's assistance that the Obama administration now says could be under review. Also new tonight, a report out, though, that the U.S. may have had much more to do with this uprising than anyone previously imagined. WikiLeaks has released secret U.S. diplomatic dispatches that show an activist in Cairo working with the American embassy there to reveal the plan by opposition groups to overthrow President Hosni Mubarak and install a democratic government this year in 2011. So, the question is this. Is America's secret backing of rebel leaders behind the majority of this uprising? For more, we're joined by investigative journalist Webster Tarpley. Webster, should this information come as a shock?
Well, we know that WikiLeaks is being used as self-exposure by different intelligence agencies, sometimes by CIA, sometimes by MI6, so we don't know which particular kitchen this came from. The Daily Telegraph says that the entire plan was cooked up in the United States in the year 2008. Maybe, could be, but the former colonial power, in this case the United Kingdom, is always the prime suspect, and I think we can look at them, especially the ability of the British to speak through Al Jazeera, which they influenced very, very heavily. Those little emirates in the Gulf where Al Jazeera comes from are all British creations, right, going back 100 years. But I think what we have, obviously, is the CIA, no doubt about it. They are playing the card of mob rule. The technical term is ochlocracy across the entire Arab world. It looks to me like a va-banque, right? It's a double or nothing strategy. They seem to be shooting the works for destabilization.
But why would U.S. officials, and as you say, the CIA, be working so hard, a three-year plan, as you say, to overthrow a government that they kind of worked pretty well with?
Well, Mubarak is not dependent enough. He's not dependent enough on NATO. He's not dependent enough on the IMF. Above all, they're looking for some kind of energetic regimes that could be played against Iran or for other purposes. They're also trying to appeal to this generation of young nihilists across the Arab world whose imaginations have been captured by Assange. Now, underneath that, there are real grievances. The food price, the gasoline price, the unemployment. But those really have more to do with the Wall Street depression than with somebody like Mubarak. Then, of course, there is the question of political oppression and repression, which has been going on in Egypt. On the other hand, you look at the double standard. If you burn a bank in Greece, you're a villain. If you burn the party headquarters in Cairo, you're a hero of democracy, of course.
Of course. That's how the grand chessboard works, my friends. One last clip here on Egyptian events, where a CNBC anchor implies that the U.S. must support dictators to keep that cheap oil flowing.
And finally, a story that you've reported on for so long now, unrest from Tunisia to Egypt to Yemen. Any effect yet in the overseas markets or here in the United States?
Yes, and you know, Joe, our angle on this is interesting. You look at Egypt, we have seen it in the market. It's down 20%. This is one of the most developed economies in the Middle East. As we said yesterday, the second biggest economy in the Middle East. One angle, we've been talking to a lot of the wealthy people, and I heard you all talk about your friend who had family there. You know, what I've been hearing, and this has surprised a lot of the wealthy, is that a lot of children of the wealthy who run the big companies in Egypt and really control this economy want to go out on the street and be a part of this.
Wow.
You know, that this is not just even middle class, highly educated, English-speaking kids want to be a part of it, and a lot of the wealthy who you would think are most in bed with the regime are actually very much in favor of regime change. I mean, they prefer it to be orderly, obviously, but the people that you would think of the most at stake are for some sort of regime change and specific ideas on power sharing. One quick thing to add, though, guys, you know, you've talked so much about the role of social media in this.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's another thing that's a big part of it, and that's the financial crisis. You came into this financial crisis with countries that had very high unemployment, and it got a lot worse. Their trade situation was decimated, so their unemployment went even further through the roof as food prices were going higher. The financial crisis in the United States and in Europe completely transformed this region. So I think that's
fascinating.
That's something to think about. And one more thing, I know we got to go, guys, but on whether this spreads, if this spreads, democracy in the Middle East spreads, the United States could take a huge hit. Because democracy in a place like Saudi Arabia, you've talked a lot about who might come in power. What that means for oil prices, they're going to go stratosphere.
There's no doubt about it.
There you go. Yeah. Aaron
no doubt about it.
Thank you very, very much. Have a great weekend.
All right, you too.
Oh, now we should also point out that those hosts there thanking the reporter for implying that the U.S. must support dictators to keep the cheap terror juice a-flowing. That was, of course, Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. Oh, that's right. The daughter of Z-Big. Down the rest of our Egyptian events updates. Endgame in Egypt from BeliefNet. King Tut in danger from copycat effect. Washington's blog notes 2 million march in Cairo, Egypt. Press TV says 5 million hold protest in Egypt. Meanwhile, Haaretz reporting United Nations human rights chief says that at least 300 reported dead in Egyptian protests, and that headline is now days old. Meanwhile, Connecticut National Guard detachment is heading to Egypt. That's from theday.com. Meanwhile, Ron Paul calls the Egyptian mess just that, and it was made by U.S. interventionism. A fascinating angle from biggovernment.com, and this is the only place I had seen this, and I even asked the aforementioned Webster Tarpley, who just joined the Twitterverse, at Webster G. Tarpley, if he has heard anything about the Muslim Brotherhood, which, of course, were established by British intelligence in the 20s. We've always controlled and radicalized Muslim movements because we need to create an enemy. We need to throw down the gun in front of the little sheep herder so he can pick it up so we can shoot him and say, he had a gun. Did the Muslim Brotherhood learn their Day of Rage protest tactics from Obama allies Bill Ayers, Bernadine Dorn, and Code Pink? 1 year ago, BigGovernment.com reported the anti-American global left, led by Code Pink, traveled to Egypt to undermine the blockade of Hamas-controlled Gaza. Obama funder and Code Pink co-founder Jody Evans, accompanied by Obama's Hyde Park friends and neighbors, the former Weather Underground terrorists Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn, organized an inside-outside game of political theater to bring pressure on the Mubarak regime to allow the aid for Hamas to be delivered through Egyptian checkpoints. On one hand, Evans and Code Pink lobbied Mubarak's wife for assistance, as well as the U.S. Embassy in Cairo. On the other hand, the group led hundreds of Western leftists in challenging the Egyptian government with boisterous street protests. Code Pink was not shy about its support for Hamas. The group bragged that Hamas terrorists guaranteed their safety in Gaza. At the same time, Code Pink had also allied itself with the Muslim Brotherhood. Code Pink took out banner ads on the Muslim Brotherhood's official English-language website asking jihadis to join us in cleansing our country of war criminals, including Bush and his wife. The Muslim Brotherhood is banned in Egypt and is widely considered to be the father of modern Islamic terrorist movement. It's telling that the protest one week ago this day, in Egypt were dubbed by the Muslim Brotherhood a day of rage. Days of rage is what the weathermen called their violent, riotous protests in Chicago in 1968 and 9. The question is begged, what have Obama allies Ayers, Dorn, and Code Pink taught the Muslim Brotherhood and other anti-Mubarak organizations in Egypt about using protests, riots, and the modern social media to coordinate their actions to undermine the Mubarak regime? Putting aside the left-right hoo-ha coming from BigGovernment.com and Andrew Breitbart's site, again, we're nonpartisan here. We can see through the facade of both the fake left and right. However, as good a work as some of those sides do, they don't see it all the way through and see how many things are funded, shepherded, fostered, infiltrated, misdirected. Did the Muslim Brotherhood, again, already an intelligence establishment creation, did they learn the Day of Rage tactics from other intelligence assets like Ayers and Dorn and Code Pink? Facing growing protest, Yemen's president says he won't seek another term. Meanwhile, he's also going to hold an emergency parliamentary meeting. More on that from Raw Story and the Deutsche Press Agency. And we close out all our Egyptian event updates posted to the bottom of CIA CFR envoy Frank G. Wisner sent to speak to Mubarak. A little flashback video for you. A new beginning. Obama speaks to the Muslim world from Cairo. I don't think I need to tell longtime listeners that there's a lot going on here in the world stage, this theater of operations, and all the world a stage. And we see these players that are the shadows on the wall, but there is some type of grand opera going on here. And we just do as best we can. Our little area here is to try and give out a bunch of information with some context and some subtext to flesh it out. Police state updates. I've changed my plea to guilty. America, a more gilded cage than Egypt, but nonetheless still a cage. An excellent piece from Washington's blog getting into the fact that we're getting our internet kill switch here. We have our continuity of government operations that have been put into play, at least publicly, since 9/11. Renewed each year so far by now Obamasiah. It's now a tradition. The government militarizes the Super Bowl as yet another Black Sunday arrives.
The Texas Army National Guard's Joint Task Force 71 is working in conjunction with civil support teams, also known as CSTs, from several other states to provide a safe, secure environment for Super Bowl 45 in North Texas. The CSTs are working with local agencies to accomplish that mission.
We have what we call the Special Operations Team. It's a part of fire rescue. We provide hazmat, weapons of mass destruction response, as well as technical rescue. And the CST is basically augmenting us. They're bringing us things that we don't ordinarily have in terms of equipment, manpower, some knowledge and expertise.
We don't come in to take over the first responders. We're here to assist them in any way, shape, and form.
The military and local organizations working together here believe that vigilance and preparation are key to an incident-free event.
Looking forward to what the Army can bring to the table and offer us, as well as what we can offer them and work together. It's been great.
We're there to help. We're for the state. We're for the region. Whatever we can bring to the table as far as emergency response comes, we'd like to help.
Reporting from North Texas for the 100th Mobile Public Affairs Detachment, I'm Army Sergeant Luke Allen.
Coming from the police state's mouth itself, and we'll just have to wait and see what ridiculous predictive programming runs and is called advertising during, again, the great Super Bowl. Super Bowl journey ignites memories of JFK assassination. This article is on NFL.fanhouse.com, and it's about a guy who's from Dallas who gets into his memories of JFK's assassination and talks about the triangulation of fire and all of those sorts of things. An odd intersection of stories. But that's, again, to say what you can get when you subscribe to keywords and phrases. And in this case, subscribing to JFK plus assassination, you get strange stories like this. Let's tie another one in from Deutsche Press Agency again. Americans recall the Reagan legacy and will mark his 100th birthday this Sunday, February 6th, right during the Super Bowl. Black Sunday. Remember, Black Sunday was the film by John Frankenheimer, the director of The Manchurian Candidate, who drove Bobby Kennedy to the Ambassador Hotel the night he was murdered. He made a movie about terrorists attacking the Super Bowl. TSA invades roads and highways with their Viper checkpoints. That's V-I-P-R. Arizona City plans to fingerprint pharmacy customers. And an interesting one from DomainB.com. 3M completes their acquisition of Cogent Incorporated. And a hat tip to a listener and a fellow Twitterverse. And again, I don't have it right with me. I can't give the hat tip to who sent me this information, but it's appreciated. And again, our Twitter feed has become quite active in the last several months, twitter.com/media monarchy. So why would a sticky note company want to buy Cogent Incorporated? because Cogent Incorporated is biometrics. They are the Minority Report. That's why multinational corporations like 3M want to get into it, which they say in the press release, because we'll be able to get a lots of sweet Homeland Security contracts. Russia to adopt universal ID card in 2012. That's from Singularity Hub. Jihad Jane to change her plea to guilty. That's from the LA Times. Jihad Jane, one of our misdirected homegrown errorists. And as soon as I saw that headline, it made me think of the song from Morrissey, I've Changed My Plea to Guilty, which I included in the links in this post, but I'll spare you, because we just heard from the Moz on the previous episode. UK border agent fired for putting his wife on the terrorist watch list. This is from Threat Level, and it's worth noting that she was stranded in Pakistan for 3 years because she was unable to fly back to the UK. Our last note on police state updates, I've changed my plea to guilty. A link to subscribe to another great news site that I found. And again, my Google feeds and bookmarks are overflowing, and that's why we keep building more websites and keep putting out more and more information and raw data for you. InjusticeEverywhere.com. I give the link for their feed, and you can get their daily police misconduct news feed. So subscribe to that and subscribe to Murder, Suicide, and you'll be thoroughly disgusted. FBI hunts the 9/11 gang that got away. This is the third story we cover on the most recent episode of NewWorldNextWeek.com. WikiLeaks bombshell points to 9/11 stand down. You won't get any of that angle from the Telegraph, briefly. The FBI has launched a manhunt for a previously unknown team of men suspected to be a part of the 9/11 attacks, the Daily Telegraph can disclose. Secret documents reveal that the three Qatari men conducted surveillance on the targets, provided support to the plotters, and had tickets for a flight to Washington on the eve of the atrocities. The details of the secret 9/11 team have emerged in a secret American government document obtained by WikiLeaks and passed to the Daily Telegraph. It was sent between the American Embassy in Doha and the Department for Homeland Security in Washington. Many more links in there for you to investigate this story, as we're all going to have to do a little more investigation on this story. None of the names come up in the historycommons.org complete 9/11 timeline. But let's get our other barely related 9/11 updates posted to the bottom of this. WikiLeaks bombshell points to 9/11 stand down posting. P. Diddy in the bizarre case of the 9/11 conspirator. Puff Daddy sued for $1 trillion blamed for 9/11. A crazed fan has filed a lawsuit saying that he was responsible for bringing the towers down and claiming they have a child together, and just unstable ridiculousness going on in our bizarre media messed up world. We're well into hour number two here, my friends, on episode 204 from MediaMonarchy.com. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com, your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. Episode 204, it is 204, it's February 4th. And we're broadcasting live on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, zeropointradio.com, and revereradio.net. And again, huge thanks to Free Radio Olympia, Berkeley Liberation Radio, One Sky Radio, Patriot Radio, Ground Zero Radio, KBOO.info, Radio23.org, TragedyandHope.com, and all the other fantastic sites and folks and outlets and individuals helping spread and collect and disseminate information. Obama continues the elite's agenda of leading the U.S. to tragedy. This is from Press TV, state media out of Iran. The U.S. president is incapable of coping with the changing world brought along by ignorance of its own internal welfare, a president of Binary Economics says, describing the situation as a tragedy for Americans. President Obama's foreign policy is bankrupt, and his domestic policy is bankrupt as well, said Rodney Shakespeare, a binary economics professor, adding, I regret to say that America has lost its way domestically in exactly the same way it's lost its way in foreign policy. Shakespeare told Press TV that the problems in America's domestic policy lie in the country's housing crisis, enormous deficit, and high unemployment rate. In foreign policy issues, Shakespeare said, America's been supporting totalitarian, torturing regimes. It supports regimes that are anti-democratic. It was taken surprised by the Tunisian revolution. In respect to Egypt, it's now coming out and making it quite clear that it wants a military crackdown. Shakespeare went on to say that Obama is dealing with a gamut of problems, trying to overcome domestic and foreign policy issues, including those of a polarized bipartisan split in the House of Representatives and turmoil in friendly authoritarian Arab countries. 2 years into his presidency, Obama has failed to deliver on a significant number of his campaign slogans, and that's what they were, including to upend the lobbying culture in Washington, ending the Iraq War, stabilizing Afghanistan, bolstering the U.S. economy, and bringing transparency to Washington, he added. We can get the clip from Press TV where binary economics professor Rodney Shakespeare said there is no way forward for the U.S.
The warnings are serious because at long last there is a recognition that the levels of debt in the United States economy have built to what are essentially unrepayable levels. Debt which cannot be repaid or won't be repaid. The debt consists of the individual state's debt, town debt, city debt, corporation debt, and of course there's the ongoing housing and foreclosure crisis, which is going to get worse this year because 2011 is the year of the adjustable rate mortgage, when the mortgages reset from very low interest rates up to very, very high ones. So the overall situation is the United States is in a bad situation. It's exported all its jobs, and then there are two other aspects to it. Firstly, it is completely refusing anyway to lessen its huge military expenditure abroad. And the other aspect of the situation is that the United States is the effective reserve currency of the world. And that has enabled it to survive by essentially printing money. Now, all these chickens, these weaknesses are now being revealed. And so you're starting to see warnings are saying, dear, oh dear, the United States currency could go down. Of course, there's a situation in which other countries are poor as well, and that is because they are all part of a system which believes it is a good thing to go into debt, interest-bearing debt, and that when you get into trouble, that you increase the interest-bearing debt. In a very profound way, the Western financial system is weakening, is going to competitive devaluations, and part of that is the weakness of the United States. Now, there is no way forward unless the United States addresses the causes of the problems. And it must start by cutting its military expenditure, and secondly, it must stop exporting its jobs. Thirdly, it must address the problems of Main Street America.
We have posted below this, Obama continues elite's agenda of leading U.S. to tragedy. Related Obamasiah updates. Hundreds of liberal activists pledged to oppose Obama in 2012, led by David Swanson, MoralNet from Raw Story, and perhaps even this is what caused maybe Obama and Immelt to get together and fire Olbermann. Not only do we not want him to get reelected in 2012, we don't want to even have him renominated. Spiraling defense spending. Public says cut the Pentagon. Obama says increase it. More on that from Global Research. Protesters march outside the Koch brothers' retreat. More on that from the Los Angeles Times. Rumsfeld to receive Defender of the Constitution Award at the upcoming CPAC convention. That's the second story we discuss on the latest episode of New World Next Week. And we end those related Obamasiah updates with a story, Dateline, Chicago. In a unanimous decision handed down on Thursday, the Illinois Supreme Court ruled that former White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel was sleazy enough to be included on Chicago's mayoral ballot. It is the opinion of this court that Mr. Emanuel is coarse, vulgar, and power-hungry to such a degree that he would be eligible to hold this city's highest office, Illinois Justice Robert R. Thomas wrote in his majority opinion, adding that Emanuel also met a key stipulation requiring that any mayor of Chicago be a bully, willing to do whatever is necessary to push his agenda through the city council. Further, Mr. Emanuel is a sleazebag and a sleazeball, both of which are criteria he fulfilled prior to filing his papers with the local election board. The decision overturned an appellate court's ruling that Emanuel was only sleazy enough to be the governor of Illinois and that he lacked the slithery, snake-like attributes necessary to oversee the morally bankrupt cesspool of Chicago politics. Barely qualifying as satire from The Onion. But we have related EconoCrash updates as well. Wall Street execs on their new terror threat info. We've got it from NBCNewYork.com as well as from MSNBC. Wall Street has been warned of a terror threat.
Security officials say the next target of Al-Qaeda terrorists could be Wall Street banks and the executives who run them. WNBC investigative reporter Jonathan Daines joins me now with the exclusive details. What are you learning about this threat?
Well, over the last several weeks, FBI and NYPD officials have been briefing bank executives and security officials concerned based on various pieces of intelligence that package bombs or the like could be sent directly to bank executives at some of these major financial institutions. They stress there's no specific threat information or any specific assassination plot underway, but they remain concerned that based on Inspire magazine, which is this English language Al-Qaeda publication, calling for attacks on financial institutions, some web postings that are out there, and some other intelligence information they have, that they may single out some specific individuals. And we spoke with Peter King yesterday, who also voiced concern that names of banking executives may be among the information being discussed.
How tight is security among these Wall Street firms anyway?
It's extremely tight in and around the facilities, and part of these meetings are they want these banks to really step up their security for the mail rooms and any packages and deliveries they receive. Because remember that air cargo plot back in October where bombs or explosives were hidden inside cartridges. It's that kind of thing they're worried about, piecing together some of the messaging that is out there on the internet and in the Inspire magazine and other intelligence.
Thank you for keeping tabs on that, Jonathan. Appreciate that.
Security officials have new concerns that Al-Qaeda in Yemen is looking for ways to strike at financial institutions like Goldman Sachs, Citibank, Bank of America, Barclays, and others. News 4 has learned in some cases the names of top banking executives have been discussed by terror operatives overseas. One senior security official stresses there is no specific threat and there's, quote, no indication of a targeted assassination plot directed towards any Wall Street executive.
A name, a picture, identification, it's always caused for more concern. Because, again, the fear is that that's sending a specific signal to specific operatives in this country to take action.
The FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force is warning banks to be on the lookout for packages that could contain bombs or chemical or biological agents. Some of the concern comes from analysts piecing together information contained in recent editions of Al-Qaeda's Inspire magazine. This latest Wall Street threat information also comes after the failed Al-Qaeda plot in October to explode cartridge bombs on planes heading into the U.S. The latest edition of Inspire called for striking at, quote, disbelievers' wealth, and officials say it also refers to the use of anthrax. NBC terror consultants also point to a separate Al-Qaeda-linked blogger who has posted information about suicide bombers in the past, before any information was publicly known, including the recent failed bombing in Sweden. That same blogger, Abu Suleiman al-Nasser, recently wrote, "Rush my Muslim brothers to targeting financial sites and the program sites of financial institutions, stock markets, and money markets." Since 9/11, the NYPD has greatly stepped up security in and around financial institutions, and they're reminding bank security teams to be extra vigilant.
So, from the intelligence standpoint, it's good to get this kind of story out there ahead of the inevitable attacks upon Wall Street and banksters that are going to come from just formerly average Americans who have been driven to the brink of insanity by controlled financial demolitions, creating this new financial world order. So put out the story ahead of time to say, oh, it's Al-Qaeda. They want to get Wall Street. Why would they want to knock out their main funding arm? Our final Econo Crash note posted at the bottom of this, Obama continuing the elite's agenda of leading us to tragedy post New York City about to lay off tens of thousands of teachers. You know, no big deal. We're now going to move, if we can do it, for the remaining half hour of this episode 204 from MediaMonarchy.com. We're going to blast through all the other related media coming from all the other growing sites in the Media Monarchy Kingdom, and we'll begin, continuing the theme already, on HolyHexes.com, Obamasiah to deliver major speech on personal faith. And my personal note is, the king's speech comes amid chaos in the kingdom. Obama gave an unusually personal speech about his religious faith on Thursday at a high-profile prayer breakfast in Washington. A window on the way he approaches prayer, his study of scripture, and some other spiritual disciplines that affect his daily life. The National Prayer Breakfast came on the heels of public opinion surveys that show only a minority of Americans know that Obama is a Christian and that a growing number believe he's a Muslim. The address was, of course, televised and streamed live on WhiteHouse.gov, and some of the updates from The Guardian and BeliefNet. Obama affirms his Christianity and brushes off critics who would question his faith. Now, another one from BeliefNet added to these related updates at the bottom of this post. Gabriel Gifford's husband, astronaut Mark Kelly, speaks at National Prayer Breakfast. And what do we see now, this morning, in the news? Gifford's husband, astronaut Mark Kelly, decides to command a space shuttle. The astronaut husband of Representative Gabriel Giffords, Democrat of Arizona, will be at the command seat of the space shuttle Endeavor when it lifts off on its final flight in mid-April. Mark E. Kelly gained international attention after Giffords was shot in the head while meeting with constituents in January, has stayed away from work for several weeks to focus on his wife's recovery, but Kelly will rejoin his five other shuttle crew members and will explain his decision for resuming command at a 3 p.m. news conference at the Johnson Space Center outside Houston. That would be coming up in about a half hour from as I speak to you now. So, referring yet again to this amazing space psyopera, if you will, there are a lot of things going on in these memes and these names and these moves that we see. He decides to pilot the space shuttle. Of course, we discussed last week the space shuttles and perhaps their esoteric meanings. Columbia, Endeavor, to reach Atlantis. Challengers will be destroyed. Furthermore, on HolyHexes.com, an article from the Daily Mail that's interesting by itself, but of course the headline they add made it even more noticeable. Charles Manson faces longer spell in jail. Caught with a cell phone again. Cult killer Charles Manson has been caught with a smuggled mobile phone for the second time in less than 2 years. According to spokeswoman Terry Thornton at Corcoran State Prison in California, the 75-year-old was found by guards to be in possession of the phone on January 6th. He had previously been caught with a mobile phone in March 2009. On that occasion, Manson had been calling and texting people in California, Florida, Jersey, and British Columbia. A press release from Christian Newswire, rushing ahead to Armageddon, Russia, Iran, and the invasion of Israel. With tensions in the Middle East escalating daily, the world seems to be on the brink of ruin. It seems like we are standing on the cusp of Armageddon and the end of the world. The Gog-Magog War of Ezekiel 38 and 39 seems as if it's about to finally be fulfilled. Rushing ahead to Armageddon, Russia, Iran, and the invasion of Israel takes on and challenges the popular end times view of Ezekiel 38 and 39 through a thorough and exegetical analysis of Ezekiel's most well-known and discussed prophecies. A new book from Christopher M. Jones, links for you to read more into and about Ezekiel 38 and 39. And, of course, also, you'd want to read about Gog and Magog, Magog, of course, being the name that George Herbert Walker Bush took on as his name in the Order of Skull and Bones. Study says religiosity gene will dominate society. This from Slashdot. Phys.org is reporting on a study by Robert Rothorn, emeritus professor at Cambridge University, that predicts that the genetic components that predispose a person towards religion are currently hitchhiking on the back of the religious cultural practice of high fertility rates, and that provided the fertility of religious people remains on average higher than that of secular people, the genes that predispose people towards religion will spread. Citing, not the least of which, the Amish. The religiosity gene. You can go download that entire report from Robert Rothorn on Phys.org. Catholic Church seeks to turn occultists from spirituality. This from the Daily Mail. A guide on how to convert witches to Christianity has been published by the Roman Catholic Church in Britain. The move comes in response to fears that growing numbers of teenagers are being lured into Wicca, occult practices, and paganism by the heroic depiction of witches in entertainment, including the Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Apprentice films and TV. The booklet, called Wicca and Witchcraft, Understanding the Dangers, offers parents advice on what to do if one of their children takes an interest in witchcraft. Unfortunately, Amazon UK is all sold out of the Wicca Witchcraft Understanding the Dangers booklet. And again, thanks to my man, Zach, one of our newest contributors on holyhexes.com. Any of these areas that we cover and have a name for here in the Media Monarchy Kingdom, whether it's war whores or geopolitics or murder and mayhem, if you have a passion in that area, as bizarre as that may sound, and want to get involved, we're growing the kingdom, building castles in the kingdom and turning the keys over to everybody out there. MediaMonarchy@gmail.com. Our last note on Holy Hexes is the pop culture list of headlines, Lullabies for the End Times. The first is an article from the ManilaStandardToday.com where they get into the fact that, again, these are chaotic times. They mention two albums, music for chaotic times, and if we had more time here, I have some of the tracks I was going to play them for you, but they cite Lalipuna, an electronic slash ambient group, and their latest record, as well as The Clientele, Lullabies for the End Times. Again, there are so many things I wish I could go into further detail, but as long as we're casting the wide net here and going over everything in the kingdom, we're going to have to keep moving along. Meanwhile, making notes on the side that I want to make notes about, like I forgot to tell you that, of course, Frank Wisner Jr. is connected to Enron and both Bushes and all of those things. But back to Holy Hexes. Bird, fish, cow, death reports wane, but biblical end times prophecy marches on. That's from GodDiscussion.com. The North Carolina Register reporting on a nation and its demons as the right hits movie screens. Churches claim they need exorcists now more than ever. Wouldn't you know it? When a film comes out and telling you, oh, your daughter might be possessed with the devil, well, God, wouldn't you know it? There are all kinds of people who think their kids are possessed. Exorcists warn parents of rise in demonic websites. Do you notice a theme here? That's from CatholicHerald.co.uk. But we return to film and even the Sundance Film Festival. For first, from slashfilm.com, in a film, stop saying film, Take Shelter. Actor Michael Shannon foresees the end times. Michael Shannon starred in William Friedkin's Bug. Of course, William Friedkin, the director of The Exorcist and The French Connection. Michael Shannon is also, I believe, currently on Broadway in a new play by Craig Wright. But meanwhile, from the PhoenixNewTimes.com, cults and uncertain futures dominate Sundance Film Festival, and they run down the list of all these films that are related to end times Armageddon scenarios, as we've said time and time again here. Now, no matter what camp you're in, every camp has their doomsday scenario coming very soon, and we're all seemingly praying for it. Glenn Beck fuels end times hysteria over Egypt. That's from religiousdispatches.org. U.S. Marine for Christ prompts lawsuit at Colorado Academy. And from Swaziland, there is a teen cult there claiming to have powers to cause fatal road accidents. More on that from times.co.sz for Swaziland. Gawker reporting on the terrifying new printing facility with which Scientology will use to bury its enemies in pamphlets. Another fantastic piece from VigilantCitizen.com on the occult symbolism of the Los Angeles Central Library. All you got to do is click that link and look at the all-seeing eye of Horus atop the library in the City of Angels. And we close HolyHexes.com with a report that is essentially at the very heart of Holy Hexes. Reports of Weeping Mary statue in Ohio draws visitors.
The statue of Mother Mary crying inside Our Lady Queen of Reading Religious Lending Library is bringing tears to some visitors' eyes.
I believe it's true. They were there. I mean, I saw them. They were actually true. It's true. And it's more than, I would imagine it's a miracle.
Our cameras were not allowed inside, but visitors snapped photos of the Virgin Mary. You can see two teardrops on her face. One rests on her chin, the other on her cheek. There is another statue of Jesus sitting at the top of the stairs with tears falling from its eyes.
I heard about it on the radio and didn't think much of it. And then being here at work, we saw the lineup of people. And curiosity, I went over and looked. And it's unbelievable. It's forming. The idea, the tears there. It does not look like it's been water or anything. It's just, it's real weird. Very weird.
Most want to believe what they see.
Well, I have faith that it is, and you know, I'm not, we can't always be sure, but I prayed sure, and I feel better about it, and I'm glad I came.
There are more visitors arriving every day as word spreads about the crying statues. We're told the owner wanted to keep it a secret for fear the statues would stop crying. Others say they believe the tears are a sign of hope. They believe it should be shared with the community.
You hear about it in other countries, and then it's like here in Reading, I mean, of all places. But yeah, it is. It is a miracle. I think it is. I think something will come of it, hopefully. Something good.
Oh, God. You devil. Let's now move to another site in the Media Monarchy Kingdom. This one's cyberspacewar.com. For the kill switch, Obama administration fears Egypt-style revolt in the U.S. The Obama administration is busy attempting to pass legislation that would essentially give the president a kill switch for the internet in the U.S., while at the same time decrying Egyptian authorities for shutting down the internet in a bid to deflate the unfolding revolution against Mubarak. The reason's simple. The government fears an Egypt-style revolt occurring in the U.S. and wants to block access to the World Wide Web if and when it happens. While Obama criticizes Egyptian authorities for shutting down web access to disrupt protesters, his own administration prepares to launch a fresh attempt at instituting the exact same powers in America, which, as recent history clearly demonstrates, represents tools for tyrannical regimes who wish to silence legitimate political opposition. The Lieberman, Rockefeller, Snow, kill switch bill. Republicans, Democrats, Independents, doesn't matter. China can control the web. We want that here, too. More on that from CNET. And the article that we just briefly noted is from Paul Joseph Watson. One related note posted at the bottom. Homeland Stupidity's new terror alert system to, of course, use Facebook and Twitter. Surprise, surprise. Further down, the cyberspace war kingdom has Stuxnet returned to Bushehr reactor. Russia warning Iran, too dangerous to bring the Bushehr reactor online. Coming from Debka file, Stuxnet hits Bushehr again. Russia warns of nuclear explosion. Again, bizarre things going on as we cover these stories in outer space, in cyberspace, and in inner space. Three posts on three different but all fascinating individuals, the first of which you already know about, William Cooper. An article from Norio Hawakawa, who's a UFO researcher, wonders if William Cooper was a manipulated misinformant. Without getting into any of those things and whether or not Bill Cooper really believed in UFOs or aliens or any of those things, we highly recommend both myself and Alan, one of the editors on cyberspacewar.com, checking out William Cooper's seminal series, the Mystery Babylon series. It would explain a hell of a lot of things that we just kind of briefly reference here, whether that's Columbia or all the other surrounding stories. Bill Cooper, of course, also the author of Behold a Pale Horse. And I looked, and behold, a pale horse. And upon him rode death. There's also a post about Bob Lazar. And you can find some videos related to Bob Lazar on Google Video. I believe I even had one of my own posted there before Google killed my account a few years ago. And there's also the father of space travel, Hermann Oberth. Hermann Oberth, Bob Lazar, and William Cooper, all covered in recent posts on cyberspacewar.com. But we'll close out the coverage with the DEF CON, kill switch, bandwidth, floodgates. As Egypt returns to the internet, Lieberman says U.S. internet kill switch bill is different than Egypt's internet kill switch. It's not fascism when we do it. Right? You can get more on that all around in the amazing graph from Threat Level showing the drop-off of Egyptian internet traffic and then the return. Meanwhile, U.S. tests system that beats internet censorship by dictatorships. Connecting to that, certified lies, the PDF posted up on Cryptogon.com, detecting and defeating government interception attacks against SSL. Meanwhile, Vodafone colluded with Egyptian regime's information warfare psyop. TechDirt.com reporting that metered bandwidth isn't about stopping bandwidth hogs, it's about preserving the old media business models, i.e. Internet 2. U.S. peer-to-peer traffic lower than the world average. U.S. Cyber Challenge partners with Lockheed Martin and Microsoft, which connects right to U.S. recruiting young cyber warriors. Lockheed Martin, Microsoft, other private military contractors infiltrating our schools, teaching our kids to be Stasi snitch cyber snoops. Those are going to be the only jobs in the Brave New World Order. Documents in the Julian Assange rape investigation leak onto the web, appropriately enough, and you can also watch Julian Assange's boring 60 Minutes interview in response to all the cyber propaganda flying around. Threat Level also getting into, no, hackers can't open Hoover Dam floodgates. But we'll blast off to space for the last two notes. NASA spots 54 life-friendly planets, in addition to the, I believe, 1,000 other possible planets that have been sighted. But we'll close it out with UFOs hovering over Jerusalem.
A UFO hovers over one of the holiest sites in Islam, the Dome of the Rock on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, the spot where the Prophet Muhammad ascended to heaven, built on top of a site sacred to Judaism. An American woman takes it all in her stride, seen it all before.
We've seen them in Mississippi like this, but never like that.
Easily dismissed as a hoax until you see this. The same event, or so it seems, filmed from a different angle by someone else. The glowing ball of light dropping until it hangs just over the Dome of the Rock. These spectators a little more impressed.
Whoa! Whoa.
Is that
the ball suddenly shooting off as if disturbed. If it's a hoax, it's very well done. We are not alone. Or are we?
All these things, of course, always done tongue-in-cheek. There are UFOs. Make no mistake about it. They are unidentified flying objects. However, I don't believe they're alien. And I don't think you do either. I realize as we're blasting through the clips here in Lightning Round and we still have the remaining bits to go over from foodworldorder.com, I played all the clips I had for you, except let's hit the rewind button real quick and get the breakdown on the kill switch.
A controversial bill that will empower President Barack Obama to switch off privately owned computer systems during a national cyber emergency and to prohibit any review by the court system will return this year. The idea of creating what some critics have called an internet kill switch that the president could flip in an emergency is not exactly new. In August 2009, a draft Senate proposal authorized the White House to declare a cybersecurity emergency. Meanwhile, another Senate proposal would have explicitly given the government the power to order the disconnection of certain networks or websites. House Democrats have taken a similar approach in their own proposals. Civil libertarians and some industry representatives have repeatedly raised concern about the various proposals to give the executive branch such broad emergency power. In 2001, the U.S. National Security Agency, NSA, installed specialized eavesdropping equipment around the country to wiretap calls, faxes, and emails and collect domestic communications originally targeted at Arab Americans. Over 25 eavesdropping facilities exist in San Jose, San Diego, Seattle, Los Angeles, and Chicago, among other cities. In 2009, as part of the Cyber Command, the NSA built a 1 million square feet data warehouse at a cost of $1.5 billion at Camp Williams in Utah, as well as another massive data warehouse in San Antonio. After the September 11 attacks, the government permitted the use of technical means to hack into the emails and internet communications of American citizens.
Oh, and of course, it all started after 9/11. They hadn't prepared any of this on September 10th. Yeah. Let's now move to Food World Order. Reports suggest White House pressured Vilsack to approve GM alfalfa, as Grist.org reported last week. The USDA announced late last Thursday it would allow the planting of genetically modified alfalfa, the nation's fourth largest crop, without restriction. Was the decision based on a carefully weighing of the evidence by the USDA or on political consideration emanating from the White House? Two recent media reports strongly suggest the latter. In the Wall Street Journal, Bill Thompson and Scott Kilman, two well-connected veteran ag policy reporters, directly tied the decision to the White House. Quoting, "The Obama administration Thursday abandoned a proposal to restrict planting of genetically engineered alfalfa, the latest rulemaking proposal shelved as part of the administration's review of burdensome regulation," end quote. And then there was also a puff piece related to Maureen Dowd and David Axelrod. However, all of this breaks it down that other companies involved in the initiative, including Monsanto, connected to USAID, and other grain trading behemoths like Archer Daniels Midland, Cargill and Bunge, agrochemical giants BASF, Syngenta and DuPont, and industrial food, quote-unquote, beverage giants, Coca-Cola, SAB Miller, General Mills, and Kraft Foods. The Obama administration's emerging vision for agriculture is sounding depressingly old. To paraphrase John Updike, haunted by memories of the Clinton and Bush administrations, when ag policymakers more or less religiously walked the big food industry line. A couple of updates from naturalnews.com and Fast Company. How to fight back against Obama's deregulation of GM alfalfa, as Stonyfield Farm and Organic Valley say they fought against GM alfalfa. We reported that to you last week, that Whole Foods, Stony Brook, and Organic Valley all caved to Monsanto. So the latter two coming out in defense of themselves, however, no such luck with Monsanto. a positive, seemingly positive update from the French agency press on a story we were posting on MediaMonarchy.com before FoodWorldOrder.com even existed, going back to September of 2008. But a good update. U.S. to regulate rocket fuel chemical in water. The U.S. government said Wednesday it plans to limit the amount of perchlorate, a chemical found in rocket fuel, explosives, and bleach that's present in the drinking water of millions of Americans. Studies have shown a pesky link between consuming perchlorate and thyroid problems in pregnant women and babies. But, you know, no big deal. We just want to limit it. This is, of course, a reversal of a decision in 2008 by the Shrub administration not to regulate water for the chemical. But then after the agency received 39,000 public comments and reviewed research by health experts, they're now slightly backtracking. EPA wants you to drink yummy, delicious rocket fuel, and they don't care. Because the water's safe to drink and the air is safe to breathe. As oil and food prices rise, Arab states buy up farmland in Africa. This coming from greenprofit.com. That's profit with a PH. In response to the recent food riots in Algeria and Tunisia and rising oil prices, some Arab states, including Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, have been buying up farmland in parts of Africa. In late 2010, the UN Food and Ag Organization announced that food prices had reached a higher level than even those back in 2008, which, of course, resulted in food riots around the world. Critics like NGO Grain argue that this land grab will displace small African farmers and only add to that continent's own food shortage problem. That post was done by our latest addition to the Media Monarchy Kingdom. That is Melissa of the Eastern Pennsylvania Permaculture Guild, helping out on foodworldorder.com. Thank you. We'll close out Food World Order with the Binge and Purge Federal Farm in Volatility Valley. Global food prices hit new record high. That's from the Telegraph. World entering era of food price volatility. That's from Reuters. Bernanke says in the Christian Science Monitor that the Federal Reserve is not to blame for food price inflation. OrganicConsumers.org notes that the U.S. is foolishly looking to Monsanto to feed the world. Meanwhile, KABC reporting on a new report that says Californians are passing up food stamps. And we close out with Yo Quiero Weird Ingredients. Thank you for suing us. Taco Bell reveals our food problems. So they're taking out ads saying, thanks for suing us so we can help set the record straight. Ecosalon.com closes it out. Taco Bell sells fake meat. So what? Everybody else is doing it. That's it for Food World Order. And we'll just again briefly mention the latest episode from NewWorldNextWeek.com. It's episode 62, CFR in Egypt, Rumsfeld Award, and the 9/11 link. And again, huge thanks to CorbettReport.com for making New World Next Week what it is. Latest episodes from James Corbett, episodes 171 and 172. 171 in the Documentaries That Matter series, professional perspectives on water fluoridation. But then on the flip side, episode 172, meet Rahm Emanuel, the son of a terrorist, the brother of a eugenicist, and also a Hollywood megalomaniac, an ex-member of the Israeli Defense Force, a gun grabber, a pickup basketball player, a White House veteran, and the next sleazy mayor of Chicagoland. Meet Rahm Emanuel. Of course, don't miss the latest Sunday update on the global awakening versus the internet kill switch, and also recent interviews with Dr. Paul Conant and Lieutenant Eric Schein of In the Zone. And of course, where would I be if I didn't mention my man Clyde Lewis of GroundZeroMedia.org live on KUFO 101.1 FM here in Portland, Oregon every Sunday night. You can go to groundzeromedia.org to support Clyde and to also get all the articles and the previous episodes and to even get the 2012 For Structuring the New Eon on DVD. And the way we'll say it, in regards to Clyde and in regards to myself and in regards to James Corbett, tragedyandhope.com, Zero Point Radio, Revere Radio, all of these outlets, if you find the alternative media enriching and invaluable in your life, please donate. Your support helps keep all of these sites going and growing and staying commercial-free and corporate unconnected. Taking a quick glance at, as I mentioned, our active Twitter feed, twitter.com/MediaMonarchy. Some of the things that get posted to there never maybe actually make it to other postings in the kingdom, so I asked questions of John Cusack of his take on the internet kill switch as he was furiously tweeting about the Egyptian events. More on Cablegate, more on the Rothschilds, swine flu vaccine likely causes childhood narcolepsy, and of course we followed NORAD so we can see when they're going into action with FEMA and other related shenanigans, the latest amazing video from Better Bad News, all of those things, it's all happening in the alternative media world. Save for some of those awesome TV shows coming from HBO and some of the better independent film. Alternative, independent, commercial-free media is where it's at. And that's why you're here, and that's why we're growing, my friends. I appreciate and love all of you guys out there, and thank you so much for your support in helping us do this. This has been episode 204 on 204-2011. My name is James Evan Pilato. I am your host and webmaster of the site and show, MediaMonarchy.com, reminding you, as always, don't hate the media, become the media. Take care.
MediaMonarchy.com is your source for alternative news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. Featuring weekly radio shows on the Portland Radio Authority, PRAradio.org, the New World Nexus video series with CorbettReport.com, plus special interview episodes, B-sides, mixtapes, and so much more. Send news tips to MediaMonarchy@gmail.com. You can make a donation or mail media to the Monarchy at P.O. Box 12165, Portland, Oregon 97212. Thanks to all the internet and community radio stations who broadcast these shows, and most of all, thanks to you. Remember, don't hate the media, become the media.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not cooperate, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.